From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Five New York City underperforming schools are being given one choice, and one choice is no choice. Edison Schools, Inc. is not the answer for New York City public schools.
Privatizing America's schools, who will profit? A debate on what happens when corporations run classrooms. We'll look at Edison Schools, Inc., from the current battle in New York to San Francisco. And two Colombians tell what it's like to be on the receiving end of America's $1.3 billion anti-drug plan, Colombia. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The White House told officials of the American Bar Association it's ending the organization's semi-official role in evaluating candidates for the federal bench. Alberto Gonzalez, the White House counsel, said in a letter to the president of the Bar Association that the Bush administration would stop the half-century-old practice of sending the names of judicial candidates to the ABA for evaluation before they're publicly announced. Underlying the dispute is the long-simmering resentment dating to 1987 by conservatives over the Bar Association's role in evaluating judges. That year, the Bar Association's Special Committee to Evaluate Judges gave a mixed rating to Judge Robert Bork, Ronald Reagan's nominee to the United States Supreme Court. Four of the committee members rated Judge Bork, then a Court of Appeals judge and a former law professor at Yale, unqualified to sit on the Supreme Court. The FBI has arrested 10 San Antonio law enforcement officials in a four-year corruption probe. Eight San Antonio police officers and two Bexar County sheriff's officers were arrested yesterday on charges of theft or using their badges and guns to protect drug shipments. The officers face 10 years to life in federal prison if convicted. FBI officials say investigation into the illegal activity began in 1997. Federal agents posed as drug dealers to catch the officers. Mexico's Zapatista rebels say they'll stay in the capital to fight for peace, accepting a proposal to promote an Indian rights bill before Congress. Rebel leader Subcomandante Marcos said Zapatista representatives would meet with lawmakers today to determine a date and format for the rebels' appearance. In a last-minute effort to salvage peace in the southern state of Chiapas, legislators narrowly passed a measure yesterday requiring at least 100 members of the 682-seat Congress to be present when the rebels make their pitch. A union representing 30,000 Panama Canal workers sued the U.S. government for $1.2 billion yesterday, saying its workers are owed Social Security and severance pay. The union alleged the U.S. government owes at least $300 million in Social Security payments that should have been made between 1979 and 1999 when the Panama Canal Commission operated the canal. The government also neglected to pay severance pay when it ceased operation of the canal, according to the lawsuit. The union is also seeking $900 million in punitive damages. The problems date back to 1979 when the U.S. first began operating under the Panama Canal Treaty. Lori Berenson, the 31-year-old New York native accused of collaborating with the Peruvian rebel group MRTA, was brought out of a concrete cell in an anti-terrorism court yesterday for direct examination by the prosecution. The move came after a court officer read a summary of Tuesday's opening proceedings in which Berenson said that being kept behind bars during the trial violates her right to a presumption of innocence. Before the presiding magistrate's order that she be seated directly in front of the three-judge panel that will decide the case, Berenson sat on a wooden bench behind bars in the courtroom. And this news from Guatemala: the country's justice system encountered delays, threats, and the bombing of a judge's house as it opened the trial of five people accused of murdering Bishop Juan Herardi, the respected human rights advocate. Bishop Herardi was bludgeoned to death in April 1998, days after he'd completed a report that accused the military of being responsible for most of the 200,000 deaths in Guatemala over the last 40 years. Several members of the military, including a father and son who had to be yanked from their cells and taken to court, are on trial, along with a priest and seminary cook who are accused of covering up the murder. This news from Guyana. Police fired tear gas and metal pellets yesterday at stone-throwing black protesters who claimed their votes weren't counted in racially tense elections. At least two people were injured. With almost 90% of the votes counted in Monday's general election, the ruling party backed by the ethnic Indian majority was far ahead, but election results expected to be announced yesterday were delayed, also inflaming the demonstrators. Elections officials said they need to check the results for accuracy, but protesters said they suspected a conspiracy to manipulate the count.
Humpty Dumpty sat on the wall. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. Woo! King's horse is not in all the king's men. Could not put Humpty back together again. Humpty Dumpty sat on the wall. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. You know all the king's horses and all the king's men. Could not put Humpty back together.
Taj Mahal singing Humpty Dumpty here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Parents of nearly 5,000 children at five New York City poorest public schools began casting ballots this week in a two-week election that will decide the immediate future of school privatization in New York City. Edison Schools, Inc., the country's largest private operator of public schools, must obtain the approval of the parents of more than half the children at each school to win the right to manage that school. The privatization plan was first promoted by Mayor Rudolph Giuliani and announced by Schools Chancellor Howard Levy in December. Community groups led by ACORN, that's the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, and the People's Coalition to Take Back Our Schools, which includes groups ranging from the Black Radical Congress to Jews for Racial and Economic Justice, vehemently opposed the plan. The battle has turned ugly at times, with Edison accusing ACORN of lying to parents and of illegally obtaining their telephone numbers. The school's chancellor on Wednesday ordered a probe of ACORN. The issue reverberates far beyond New York politics. Edison operates 113 schools in 45 cities around the country, and struggles have erupted from California to Michigan to Texas to New Jersey. Members of the Board of Education in San Francisco are currently trying to pass a resolution which would cut short Edison's five-year contract with the school district. The current battle in New York, which is home to the nation's largest public school system, is crucial to Edison's future. Many investors regard Edison as a joke. In a recent article in U.S. News and World Report, one analyst noted, "If Edison's pace in signing new contracts slows, the whole thing will be dead in the water." We're joined right now by a number of people from around the country to talk about the issue of the privatization of schools, and particularly the role of Edison Schools, Inc. Let's start with Bertha Lewis. She's executive director of ACORN, the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now. They are leading the battle in New York to stop Edison from taking over five schools. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much for having us.
So tell us what's happening. Which schools are these, since it's a national program, in terms of how they fit in socioeconomically and when Edison came to New York?
All five of these schools in New York City are in the outer boroughs, except for PS 161, which is a school located in Harlem. This school is mainly Latino and African American. That's in Manhattan. You have MS 246, MS 320. Who are mainly African American.
These are middle schools.
Middle schools and Caribbean immigrant schools, Haitian, a lot of Haitian folks. They are low and moderate income folks located in Crown Heights and Flatbush, Brooklyn. You have IS 111, which is a largely Latino school located in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And one other school, CS 66, which is located in the South Bronx.
These are the poorest schools.
Well, these are schools that are in low-income neighborhoods. They are in minority neighborhoods. And these are schools who were so-called in the chancellor's district, the sort of virtual school district in which the chancellor and the Board of Education have all the power to do whatever they please. These schools had been underperforming on standardized state tests. And for 2 years now, have been showing remarkable improvement using some of the methodology that the Edison Schools, Inc. is claiming to want to bring in, such as technology and computers and parent involvement and teacher involvement. So the question is whether or not we have a situation, just as we've had in urban renewal, where we neglect whole neighborhoods, we neglect ethnic groups, and then once they fail, we say, well, the private sector can fix it. And the reason for Edison being chosen, the Board of Education constantly says, is because they bring resources. Well, our situation is this. If, in fact, they're bringing so many resources, then why is it that the Board of Education in New York City is willing to pay them $10,000 per student if they manage these schools, where normally charter schools would only get approximately $6,000 per student? They're not bringing buildings, they're not bringing equipment or any sort of other infrastructure. And whether or not you believe that Edison Schools, Inc., that corporation, is a good choice, what's really the issue here is there was no choice for any of these parents in New York City. They were never consulted, never were part of the process. Their opinion was never considered. They've been constantly disrespected. And at this juncture, we have a vote which ends on March 30th. Asking parents to ratify a decision that was already made for them. This has been part of the failing pattern where those who don't live in these communities, who really have low expectations of them, and who really view race and class as an issue that they don't have to deal with, make decisions and then tell parents, oh, why don't you just vote? I think this is outrageous.
Let's go across the country to San Francisco. Susie Siegel is with us, a kindergarten teacher who refused to sign the charter when her school was taken over by Edison. So what happened then?
What the woman was saying from Acorn echoes almost exactly what happened in 1998 in San Francisco. People were not part of the process, and it was pretty much a done deal before people were coerced into signing the contract, the charter. And I myself was coerced into the signing of the charter, but I did not do it.
What do you mean? What is the charter?
The charter is what Edison, Inc. needs, the buy-in of the, well, now they need the buy-in of the parents, but at the time it was just the teachers. They needed buy-in from the teachers so that they could put the charter in the elementary school I was working at.
Why did you refuse to sign the charter?
I refused to sign the charter for the most part because I had no chance to look into what this Edison Inc. was all about. We weren't given any information prior to signing the charter. I was concerned that it was a corporation taking over. I thought, how could a company that's first interest would be money really be looking into the best interests of children, and that in particular the children that I was teaching, which was predominantly African American and Latino children.
Because you didn't sign, you were kicked out.
Because I didn't sign, I chose to leave, and my colleagues who were told if they signed and had a job. Signed it and still didn't have a job. So it didn't necessarily mean you got a job if you signed it, but I chose to leave because I was not happy with the process and I was not happy with the idea behind Edison.
Now, didn't Edison pick up test scores once they took over?
Well, I mean, that remains to be seen. And because the children are not the same children that were there when I was there, the data shows, for example, I had a kindergarten class with 18 African-American children, and now the data shows that there's about 5 African-American children in the kindergarten that I would have been teaching. So anytime you take out children and put in new children from more advantaged communities, of course the test scores are going to go up. I mean, it's like comparing apples and oranges, and I'm concerned about what happened to the same children that needed the help. This school was historically neglected, and these children are not getting the help that they need. And I'm concerned for New York, because it sounds like the schools are going to be put in where children are from disadvantaged communities. And I hope that Edison Inc. doesn't continue their trend of replacing the children.
Let's bring in Marshall Mitchell, Vice President of Edison Schools. What about this issue of replacing kids in the schools?
Well, in fact, it's not an issue of replacing students. What has happened, particularly in the community where the San Francisco school is, what was not said is that many of the students who either left or, and obviously you're talking about a very mobile community, those children, those African Americans, it's not as if well-to-do or middle-class whites are replacing African-American students. Students are not being counseled out. Students are not being replaced. What happens is there is a demographic shift in that community where more Hispanics are moving into that community. Where the downturn in the African-American population occurred there, an upturn occurred in the Hispanic population. So it's not as if you're comparing apples and oranges. The community changes. The same thing is true in New York City schools, where the more economically needy a person or a child is, the more likely they are to be mobile, the more likely they are to move. And I think these demographic shifts do happen. And as a school, you are not able to control the changes in the population. But what I can say is in schools that Edison is in partnership with in communities, and I hear the word takeover, but boards of trustees in the charter schools that we currently operate and manage in partnership, that local control remains there. But in communities where we are operating schools, we have seen a lower rate of transition and mobility than existing in current surrounding public schools.
What about the teacher turnover? Susie Siegel, what happened with the teachers in the new school at Edison? How many stayed?
Initially, when the charter came in, when Edison Inc. came in, it was almost complete turnover. And the following year, there was a high turnover, and last year, almost the entire staff left again, given they were unhappy with the conditions of their contract.
Marshall Mitchell of Edison Schools.
What we've been able to do across the country is negotiate contracts with either the smaller collective unit at the school or the larger unit. Under New York City, the existing collective bargaining agreement will be honored unless the UST and the Council of Supervisors and Administrators wants to make an adjustment to those contracts. So the existing contracts will be honored. Seniority rules will be protected. Pension, welfare benefits, all of those will be protected. New York State law, like similar to other laws across the country, allows something called opt-out, where if someone looks at the Edison model, looks at the approach, or is just ideologically opposed to a private company being involved in the management and operation of a school, they have the right to opt out, which accounts in many instances for high rates of turnover at Edison schools. Some people just say the longer school day, the longer school year, the more demand, the curriculum is not for them. And I think the same way the parents have the choice here in New York City, many educators also make the choice and say that it's not for them. But one thing that you'll look at, and obviously New York State law has a threshold by which we will have to employ a number of certified teachers and instructors. And obviously, we have always endeavored to have more than what the state requires, because we think it is very important in the interest of equity of having in communities of where people of color exist, certified teachers.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. Marshall Mitchell is our guest, Vice President of Edison Schools, speaking to us on his cell phone. If you're having a little trouble understanding, in the studio with us, Bertha Lewis of ACORN, Executive Director of the group. And in San Francisco, Susie Siegel, kindergarten teacher who refused to sign the Edison School charter. Mark Sanchez will be up with us next, Commissioner of the San Francisco School Board and founding member of Teachers for Change. And I want to ask him about the politics of the recent election for the school board and the role of the gap, both in the election and also in funding for the Edison schools. Then we're going to talk with a parent here in New York who's involved in the two-week election, two-week vote on whether Edison should take over some of the poorest schools in New York. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Thank you.
You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk about the privatization of public schools in the United States, specifically looking at New York, where five of New York's poorest public schools have begun casting ballots this week in a two-week election that will decide the immediate future of school privatization here in New York. Edison Schools, Inc. is hoping to obtain approval of more than half the parents at each school to win the right to manage those schools. And we're looking at what happened in San Francisco when Edison took over there. Our guests are Marshall Mitchell, Vice President of Edison Schools, Susie Siegel, a kindergarten teacher who refused to sign the charter, the Edison Charter in San Francisco, Bertha Lewis, head of ACORN, and now joining us on the phone, Mark Sanchez, Commissioner of the San Francisco School Board and founding member of Teachers for Change. Can you talk about the funding, the money involved with the last school board election in San Francisco, and how that ties into Edison?
Last year in the election cycle, it was the first time in San Francisco school board election history that big money entered the race, and this time it was in the form of from the Gap. Don Fisher, who owns the Gap, who has a big stake in Edison, put in about $50,000, he and a group of other business people, $50,000 into a pot of money for candidates that would run on a slate that was for Edison. So, and indeed, one of them got elected or reelected. It was the president, the former president of the board, and she indeed is sticking to her word. And she's the only member of the board who is currently voting against the process to look into Edison. We have a series of allegations that we're looking into.
Well, can you just explain that again? Explain the connection between Fisher, CEO of the Gap, the Edison schools, and the money going into the election?
Well, his son apparently owns. I think at the time when I read about it, 4% of Edison, he has a big stake in it. And Edison would never come to a state that funds its children at less than the national average. And so he set aside a pot of money, $25 million, for Edison to tap into it for schools that went on board with Edison. And so our school in San Francisco is able to tap into that pot of money. So he's very pro-privatization. He's been kind of pulling strings in the background, and one of the ways he did it was by putting money into the campaigns of people that were pro-Edison.
And how did that affect you? You did become commissioner of the San Francisco
School. It didn't affect me at all. I mean, he didn't approach me at all. He knew I ran on my platform was pretty much on several items and how we treat teachers. I'm a former teacher in the district, and also on Edison, which I actually taught at before it was privatized. I'm very familiar with the school and the children and the teachers there. Were there, and so everybody knew I was running, that I was going to challenge Edison.
Mm-hmm. On what grounds? And I wanted you to respond to Marshall Mitchell, Vice President of Edison Schools, saying it's not that kids are being kicked out, it's that the demographics of the school are changing.
No, actually what's happened is that the demographics of the school are changed because of the charter process. It's not really actually a function of it being privatized. If you're a charter school, you're not assigned. If you're you're not an assigned student anymore that goes there, you have to go through an optional enrollment process. So African Americans from the poorest part of town, Hunters Point, which was predominantly where the kids were coming from that were African American, aren't going through that process to get their kids. So all the incoming kids in the last 3 years have dwindled in African American population because those parents don't go through this process. The Latino parents are more likely to do that, and plus they live in that neighborhood. And actually, at the time, it's also on the cusp of a white neighborhood, a middle-class neighborhood called Noe Valley, and it had zero white parents before. Now it has 5-10% white parents, so that also contributes to their 5-10% white children, actually, and that contributes to their scores going up, of course.
Marshall Mitchell, Vice President of Edison Schools.
I was having a little trouble hearing. I heard all through the Gap and the Fisher, then I heard different points about the if you could just recap, I was having a real tough time hearing.
Mark Sanchez is saying that the schools, you're saying, did not change their demographics. Is that right, Mark Sanchez?
Not dramatically at all, Mark. And if you look at the racial breakdown of the school, the upswing certainly did occur among Hispanic and Latino students.
I agree. I'm just saying why that happened.
I couldn't hear your explanation as to why.
Okay. The reason why is because the kids have to go through an optional enrollment to get into a charter school in San Francisco. And African-American families generally do not go through that process. It's a series of does that process entail?
It's a series of hoops that you have to go through, bureaucratic hoops that you have to go through to get your kid in a choice school. And now Edison is called is a charter school that's like an alternative school here where you have to choose to go into it. And African-American families in this city historically don't go through that process. For when they were at Edison before, it was their assigned school. They had no choice. They were bused to that school, African-Americans from Hunters Point. And that's what's changed now, not the demographics of the city per se. I mean, they're still the same percentage of African-Americans in Hunters Point. They just aren't going to that school anymore. And that's just a function of the charter process. I contend that had the population stayed the same with huge proportion of really poor African-American kids from disenfranchised families and a huge proportion of Latino kids, zero white kids, the test scores would have seen very little gains.
I want to bring Norm Fruchter into the conversation, director of the New York University Institute for Education and Social Policy and co-author of the book Hard Lessons, Public Schools and Privatization. We're hearing describe what happened in San Francisco. The election now is taking place in New York about whether Edison will take over five of the poorest schools. What are the hard lessons that you've learned in your report?
Well, our book looked mostly at privatization efforts before this current wave of privatization, primarily the performance contracting that took place through the federal government giving contracts for student improvement to private firms, and the earlier wave of privatization primarily in Baltimore and Hartford. And essentially those stories are stories of failure. Student achievement didn't improve in either the waves of performance contracting or the initial privatization efforts, particularly in Baltimore. And the contracts were essentially terminated with all of the private organizations. What the underlying effort, and it certainly may be different this time, but the underlying effort in both of those waves of privatization was to try to substitute either machines, teaching machines in the case of privatization, or lower-paid labor for teacher labor, in order, I think, to reduce the cost of the whole schooling enterprise. And in both cases, those shifts reduced the quality of education that was delivered, and ultimately, in the Baltimore case, led the Baltimore School Board to actually withdraw its approval of the private firm and turn it back to
withdraw its approval. Mark Sanchez, you're in the process of trying to de-charter or withdraw the approval now before the Edison five-year contract is up?
Yeah, we're going through a pretty arduous process, actually. It will take, if we do indeed revoke the charter or the contract, the managing agreement, it'll take three resolutions from the board. We're in the middle of the second resolution, which just is giving Edison our intent to revoke. If it does pass next Tuesday, it'll give them 90 days to correct or cure the allegations that we have that we're investigating right now about Edison, which include things that Susie brought up of coercion of teachers to sign the contract, allegations of kids being counseled out because they're challenging, and the huge turnover of teachers that Susie brought up, which they lost 18 out of 25 teachers last year, 20 out of the teachers the year before. Things that are hardly able to cure now, I don't think.
Marshall Mitchell, would Edison School sue if the school board votes to end the contract?
There is an appellate process that goes moves from San Francisco up to the state level, and I have a little trouble here. And Mark, I heard Norm very well, Norm Fruchter very well, and I think Norm, just in the interest of fairness and openness, it's important to note that schools are not being privatized. Number one, they're still open enrollment; they're all guaranteed that. Children in the state who have the right to attend public schools still maintain that right. And in between Edison and the state is really the entity that holds the charter, and that is a not-for-profit educational corporation under New York state law, which is comprised of people who are locally in touch with the issues. We have done schools with urban leagues across the country, with NAACP chapters, with groups of parents and concerned educators.
Bertha Lewis wants to jump in here.
I really have to jump in here because, you know, let's be real and let's be genuine. The process here is backwards. We are not having a charter conversion process in which the parents look at charter conversion and say, yes, I want to convert to charter. And then a nonprofit board is made up of parents, teachers, community leaders, other folks. This is backwards. The management company has already been decided upon. And that management
by
company.
By the Board of Education.
By the Board of Education. And the management company will facilitate putting together a board, which in fact will be its boss. That management company, which is Edison Inc., will put together a nonprofit board that is going to rule them. I think it's backwards. I think the nonprofit board needs to be done first, and then let the nonprofit board decide on which of a variety of management models. This is backwards. This is totally bogus. And this is what our main complaint is here, that someone has made a decision on Edison Inc. or any other corporation prior to a real democratic process of a nonprofit board, and I think we're being disingenuous. I think we're using semantics when, in fact, Edison Inc. will be the main person that puts together, the main entity that puts together that board.
You and I have had similar concerns and complaints about the process, and I've admitted that to you. And what I've said is, you know, this is,
Marshall
this
Mitchell,
is
Edison,
under a different set of circumstances. It was done under an RFP, and the chancellor took his time. And
RFP in which the parents and the community had no input.
Right, but if you look at our proposal, Bertha, which was submitted in late August, we laid out very clearly a timeline and a schedule of engagement of all of the community stakeholders. And what happened was, somewhere during the process, our schedule was trumped by the schedule of the Board of Education. And that was unfortunate, because what we would have endeavored to do was to go out into the community, to work with groups like ACORN, to work with other entities, to make sure that all of the community stakeholders who have a grasp of the problems in those communities, who know these communities very well, who have wonderful and great ideas about what needs to happen in those schools. Because if you look at No Silver Bullet, which is your white paper on what needs to happen in community school boards 9 and 12, Bertha, you and I are talking about exactly the same things. And it's unfortunate that we're in the middle of a process that puts us on competing sides, because when I look at your program and I look at our program, they meld and jive very well.
I want to bring Odessa Watford into the conversation, who is a parent of two children from CS 66, Community School 66 in the South Bronx. You've got one kid who's pre-kindergarten?
Yes.
And one in fifth grade. What are your concerns? You're in the midst of this two-week vote that could determine whether your school is taken over by Edison.
Okay, my concern, first of all, is from what I've been reading about Edison, and I don't feel this is the proper company to come in and take over our schools, one. Two, I'm very upset that we didn't have a choice as parents to be a part of the process of deciding which company or what kind of plan was going to be made for our children. Everybody's getting off track. The media is getting off track of what's the main issue. The main issue is what's best for our children at this school, not who's taking over, what's best. We don't feel that Edison is best.
Why?
Why? Because of their track record. I mean, San Francisco, I've had a letter from the San Francisco School Board, all right, telling us to beware of Edison. You know, the problems that they had were taking over. We don't want them to come in and experiment with our children.
Let me ask a question about finances. At the top of this segment, I read this quote from investors who, in U.S. News and World Report, said if Edison's pace in signing new contracts slows, the whole thing will be dead in the water. Edison needs New York, the largest school system in the country. What are the figures that... it used to be that the debt per student was nearly $4,000, and now you've reduced it to $600. It makes a difference the more schools you have, right? That's the key to reducing the cost per student. Is that right, Marshall Mitchell?
Well, that's right. The same thing with any other thing that you're doing, you achieve economies of scale. And if you're doing more of the same thing, it becomes less expensive to do it. For instance, if you have 9 or 10 people who are responsible for writing your English curriculum, and you have 10 schools, obviously those are shared and spread across 10 schools. But if you have the same curriculum and it's spread across 13 schools, obviously the cost to each school goes down for that. The service is not compromised, because the curriculum, the same way the Board of Ed contracts with Success for All, the more you have under that curriculum, the less expensive it is to administer it.
If Edison doesn't get the New York schools, could it go under?
No. No, it just announced yesterday that Edison has raised another $81 million from the private sector to help build and invest in these schools. So there is still a great amount of confidence, not only in Edison's financial health, but that confidence in the financial health has come from what analysts, and analysts obviously come up with opinions on their own, and that's truly what they are. There are a number of people who have a great deal of confidence in our educational model as well as our financial model.
Well, Odessa Watford, you mentioned this letter from the San Francisco School Board and what raises concerns for you. What are some of the issues that you are worried about for your kids?
All right. We have, let's say Edison comes in, and we decide that they're not best, and we have a 90-day grace period where they can revolt. What happens when they decide they want to sue us? The playgrounds. I was in the letter. It was saying how the playgrounds became private property once Edison became, you know, running these schools. You have the after-school programs that they had in San Francisco that was free until Edison took over the schools, and then they asked for a $200 a month fee for after-school programs. In the areas that they're coming in, most of these people are on public assistance. Who can afford to pay $200 a month for your child to stay in after school?
Well, Marshall Mitchell, who can afford it?
Well, first of all, Ms. Watford, just respectfully, it's not $200. And what we did was we proposed in New York City to the Board of Education that we would raise another $50 million in philanthropy to support and expand existing after-school programs and to make programs that might currently have any kind of fee, for instance. At IS-111, you have a Boys and Girls Club, and you have a Beacon program. What we would seek to do is expand those programs.
But what if you don't get the money?
We've already begun to raise it. We already have a number of commitments in hand from organizations, from foundations, from corporations that want to make an investment in communities.
I think that's commendable. You know, I'd like to get a list of these investors, and I like to get a list of these foundations who want to make investments in our communities. You know, because I'd like to know where they were and how they're coming through. Why is it that we can only make an investment of such a large amount of capital when, in fact, there is a for-profit company connected to it? Here's my problem. My problem is this, that there is an equities here. We have a process in which there was an RFP issued, and very clearly
a request for proposals
here in New York City, which purportedly was put out to folks saying, hey, we might want to do a charter conversion process, and we need an educational management organization. And that educational management organization needed to have a certain amount of capital. So automatically, that eliminated a great deal of nonprofit organizations who did not have the benefit of all of these foundations, which I don't know where they came from, but they seem to be proliferate right now since they're connected to Edison. I'm saying this to the chancellor and to the Board of Education and to this mayor. If, in fact, you think that cash is the way to go, then this administration ought to go out and get that cash to infuse into these schools. I think Edison, Inc. ought to go out to its investors and to these other foundations, and they ought to build from the ground up charter schools in these neighborhoods and ask people to voluntarily choose them. The process of conversion, where we're taking public dollars and automatically transfer them to a for-profit company, is very troubling. I think that Edison, and I believe you, Marshall, I believe Reverend Flake, I even believe Benno Schmidt, when they say that they can produce a better product. And by the way, that's how you list the schools that you're in as product. Build charter schools, have people choose you. I don't think you want to be under a process in New York City that is so tainted as you've acknowledged from the beginning. I think what you want to have is a process in which people know all the facts, they feel comfortable with you, they're willing to face the consequences, and there's a level playing field. This conversion business has been backwards from the beginning. It is the desire of this mayor and this administration, who couldn't get vouchers and now is using the Edison Corporation to do a privatization. Now, you can say what you want. It is a move toward privatization, and you ought to acknowledge that, and you ought to be able to do this fairly. And you know what? If you don't win the vote, which, you know, would probably be surprising considering all the resources that Edison has, if you don't win the vote, I would like for all of those foundations and all those investors, please come to Bushwick, please come to Flatbush, please come to Crown Heights, please come to Harlem, and please come to the South Bronx, because we'll still be there and we'll need you.
Last question on the level of salaries. A September article by Business Week's Diane Brady cited as liabilities the lavish salaries of Christopher Whittle and Benno Schmidt, former baseball commissioner, and millions in sweetheart loans and stock option deals extended by the company to the two leaders, Whittle and Schmidt, making close to $300,000 a year, far more than any teacher, public school teacher. Schmidt's contract allows him to pocket 2 years of salary and a bonus of $2.5 million if he gets canned. I want to bring Norm Fruchter back into the conversation, who is co-author of Hard Lessons
Public
School.
Can I respond to that? Because I think those are really Edison-oriented issues and concerns. If you look at a superintendent of a school board, even smaller school boards, and have 113 and talk about a salary of $300,000, particularly with people who have invested much of their own personal money in these in a corporation, that's not a lot of money. If you're talking about recruiting a very...
No superintendents make that kind of money.
How much does the superintendent fill
$120 a year
in Philadelphia?
$120 a year in New York.
What's that?
Superintendents in New York make about $120 a year.
Not the the chancellor of New York City schools. How much does he make? And then look at Phil Goldsmith makes in Philadelphia. How much does he make?
Yeah, money? I don't know what he makes.
He makes in excess of $300,000 a year, and also housing allowances. So when you put the whole package together, you're actually talking about salaries much higher than $300,000 a year.
Norm Fruchter, will for-profit schools take care of kids as we wrap up?
I think that's one of the bottom line questions. So far, the past history says they won't do any better than public schools do, and in some cases they do worse. Edison's history is mixed across the country. Edison's got data that says that they have improved the outcomes of students. There have been a number of researchers, and there's a new study out of a university in Michigan, I forget which one, which has looked carefully at the first round of Edison schools and says there isn't any increase in test scores. That's one of the bottom lines. Can firms that are operating in the private market actually do better than public firms? The other basic question is not can Edison's investors, you know, keep coming, but in the end, can a profit be turned on this enterprise? Because no matter for how long you keep it going with new investors, at some point the bottom line has got to show profit or the investors disappear. And that's one of the troubling questions, which is if there's a profit to be made in public by running public schools, by private organizations, where does it come from? And the worry that people have had for a long time, which has been exacerbated by the previous privatization efforts, is that often the effort to turn a profit comes from reducing labor costs, either substituting machines for teachers or substituting less experienced teachers for more experienced teachers or increasing class sizes. And if you do that, in the end, even if your initial outcomes for kids are better, you're going to reduce them by those kind of strategies.
Well, I want to thank everyone for joining us. Norm Fruchter, the book is Hard Lessons, Public Schools and Privatization, a 20th Century Fund Report. Marshall Mitchell, Vice President of Edison Schools. Bertha Lewis, Executive Director of ACORN, the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now. Odessa Watford, parent of two kids in the South Bronx, one of the five schools that are now in the midst of voting on whether they will accept Edison as the manager of the schools. Susie Siegel, joining us from San Francisco, kindergarten teacher who refused to sign the Edison charter. And Mark Sanchez, commissioner of the San Francisco School Board and founding member of Teachers for Change. You can find their contact information at the website, and also if you want to listen again to the program at webactive.com. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back from our break, we're going to Colombia to look at some of the beneficiaries of the $1.3 billion that are being sent to Colombia. They'll talk about fumigation and they'll talk about paramilitaries. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. About 100 U.S. anti-war activists demonstrated in Bogota yesterday against U.S. military assistance to Colombia. The protest was staged by Witness for Peace, which opposes Plan Colombia, a $1.3 billion U.S.-backed counterinsurgency and counter-narcotics offensive. Under the plan, U.S. supplied planes protected by troops trained by U.S. Green Berets are fumigating cocaine-producing crops. Today we bring you two people on the receiving end of Plan Colombia. Carlos Palacios lives in La Hormiga in Putumayo, once a stronghold for the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. The area is now dominated by paramilitaries that began a campaign of massacres and assassinations late last year. Around the same time, the U.S. and Colombian security forces have launched an extensive aerial eradication program in the south, fumigating tens of thousands of acres of coca. Regula Medora is from Barranca Baramejo, a site of a fierce struggle between the paramilitaries and guerrillas. There, civilians and human rights organizations have faced intensified attacks, including massacres and selective killings. According to the U.S. State Department, paramilitaries have killed close to 1,000 people last year. The report noted that civil society leaders are under particular threat. Madero heads one of the human rights groups that's been targeted. Welcome to Democracy Now! Our guest will be translated by Walter Krakmal. Again, Regulo Madero, president of CREDOS, the Regional Corporation for the Defense of Human Rights. Can you describe the attacks that you're under, your group is under, and the civil society in your community are under in Colombia?
We're living in an internal armed conflict that is profoundly degraded.
Las organizaciones sociales son
social organizations are object of permanent disbandment efforts. And civil society is also under attack.
Se busca la neutralización de las organizaciones sociales.
What they're after is neutralizing social organizations in the civilian sector.
De las organizaciones defensoras de derechos humanos.
And human rights organizations as well.
Esa neutralización puede llegar
that
desde el condicionamiento
neutralization ranges from conditioning
de los grupos armados,
for the interests of the armed groups,
paramilitares,
especially the paramilitary,
hasta el desplazamiento forzado de los defensores
to the forced displacement of social leaders and grassroots organizations.
Incluso de la muerte de muchos defensores en Colombia.
And that has resulted in the death of many human rights defenders in Colombia.
La población civil es objeto de constantes amenazas
the
y constantes
civilian
abusos.
Population is under constant threat and suffers constant abuses
por causas relacionadas con el conflicto armado,
for reasons related to the armed conflict.
Pero también por causas relacionadas con grandes intereses but económicos en las
also at the
partes
hands
que el Estado
of economic interests
o ha elegido como zonas de desarrollo estratégico.
And those have been taken to places considered strategic for development.
El conflicto armado lo sufrimos los civiles.
The civilian population suffers the brunt of the armed conflict.
El 82%, el 80%
82-80%
de las víctimas
of the
del
victims
conflicto
of
armado
the conflict
y de la violencia generalizada en Colombia
and the generalized violence in Colombia
somos civiles.
Are civilians.
El resto tiene que ver con personas involucradas directamente en el conflicto armado.
The rest has to do with people who are directly involved in the armed conflict.
How has Plan Colombia changed things, has it?
El Plan Colombia ha deteriorado
Plan
la
Colombia
situación
has made the situation deteriorate, especially regarding human rights violations, and has augmented paramilitarism in Colombia.
Particularmente cuando aquí se por razones de seguridad
especially
nacional,
in light of the fact that national security concerns
se le da viabilidad al Plan Colombia
here make the Plan Colombia a viable thing.
Por encima de condicionar al Estado colombiano de respetar y garantizar
and
la protección de los derechos humanos.
Has nothing, that goes beyond conditioning the Colombian state to respect human rights.
El Plan Colombia como tal tiene presupuestado
Plan Colombia as
desplazar
such has
entre 30,000 y 40,000 personas.
To displace 30,000 to 40,000 people.
Aparte de la que del desplazamiento
aside from the displacements that are provoked by armed skirmishes between the guerrillas and the state forces.
Estamos frente a una, al escalamiento de la guerra.
We are now facing
mayor deterioro
an escalation of the war
del conflicto armado,
to greater deterioration and degradation of the armed conflict,
mayor escalamiento de la violación de los derechos humanos,
escalation of
the
human rights violations and violations of international human rights law. Many civilian organizations are going to be disbanded. Many defenders of human rights are going to have to leave the country, abandon the cities that where we live and work.
Eso es lo que nosotros queremos cambiar aquí en nuestra
gira. That's what we want to change through our visit here to the United States.
Carlos Palacios, you are a former priest displaced while serving at Puerto Guzman Parish in 1997, a local official in Larmago, and coordinator of the Community Leaders in Defense of Campesinos that advocates for victims displaced by U.S.-funded fumigation. Can you describe where you are in Colombia and what effects the fumigation of coca crops has?
En primer lugar, muchas gracias por darnos esta oportunidad de
First
compartir
off,
con
thanks
ustedes
for giving us this opportunity
la situación del sur del país donde ha sido
talk about the situation
donde
in
inicialmente
Southern Colombia,
se ha presentado la alternativa del Plan Colombia
the
como
alternatives to the Plan Colombia have been presented, such as the eradication of illicit crops.
Pues sí, yo fui desplazado en un momento por
I was displaced
guerra,
at a certain moment
guerra,
because of the dynamics of the war, because of my work
humanos,
as a human rights defender and defender of peasants. Thank God I've been able to continue developing my work in La Hormiga, Putumayo, which is in the southern region of the country, on the border with Colombia, Ecuador, and Peru. There are 56,000 hectares of coca planted in this region. As of December 22nd of this year, the anti-narcotics police forces, in conjunction with the U.S., initiated a fumigation program that falls within the anti-drug policies of the U.S. and Colombia, and which have destroyed this lung of the Amazonia region,
que han atentado contra la dignidad de nuestro pueblo,
and which have hurt the dignity of our people,
han producido graves daños ecológicos,
which have produced grave ecological damage
graves daños ecológicos,
to the region.
Que tienen hoy a nuestro pueblo en una crisis
and the result
humanitaria.
Is a humanitarian crisis
nuestro
among our people today. Our
hambre.
People is suffering hunger.
Nosotros nos habían dicho que el glifosato no causaba
they
ningún daño.
Told us that glycophosphate does not cause any damages
pero
whatsoever.
Sin embargo, a mis oficinas, que
yet,
es la oficina
in
de
my
desarrollo
offices,
humano,
which is Human Development Office
del municipio Valle del Guamuez,
of the municipality of the Valley of Guamuez,
de ese solo municipio, nosotros
in that municipality alone, we have
que fueron fumigadas 8,194 hectares,
8,194 hectares have been fumigated.
De pancoger, es decir, plátano, yuca, maíz,
which produce plátano, yuca, maíz, and other staple crops.
5,174
people have been affected,
especialmente los niños,
especially children,
a quienes les fueron afectados con vómito,
who suffered
diarrea,
vomiting attacks, diarrhea,
piel,
skin infections,
dolor de cabeza,
headaches,
fiebres,
fevers,
y distintas anomalías.
And
this is a
other
Monsanto
anomalies.
Fumigant, pesticide, Roundup.
Sí, la casa original de
yes,
la que
the original company
Roundup
that produces Roundup
is
Monsanto.
El producto activo, el Roundup, es el
the
glifosato.
Active ingredient is glycophosphate.
Pues siempre nos habíamos escuchado que el glifosato no era
we had always heard that glycophosphate was did not produce any damage, but we want to know what they're fumigating us with, which causes so much devastation.
Yo tengo fotografías, videos, pruebas
I have photos, videos, and other evidence that those who are listening can request, and we can get them to you through email.
De igual manera, quisiera también
likewise, I'd like to underline 171,643 animals
que los campesinos utilizaban para
that
su comida,
peasants used for food
fueron también muertos.
Were also slaughtered.
Well, we have come to the end of our program, but on our website at webactive.com, people will be able to get the contact information and email event, address so that they can get in touch with you and find more information. I want to thank Regulo Madero as well as Carlos Palacios, who have come up to the United States to speak about the plight of Colombians under Plan Colombia, the $1.3 billion U.S. money that is going down to Colombia. Thanks very much for joining us. Well, I'm going to be on a whirlwind this weekend in California. Look forward to seeing lots of listeners tomorrow at 4 in San Francisco at the Cathedral Hill Hotel, National Federation of Community Broadcasters. I'll be giving a speech on Monday morning at KZYX in Mendocino. I'll be spending an hour doing an interview with Alice Walker and look forward to meeting listeners there. And tonight at 7:30 in Los Angeles at the First Baptist Church, I will be there as well. And I really look forward to seeing listeners and staffs at affiliates at the National Federation of Community Broadcasters Conference in San Francisco. That does it for the program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Terry Allen and Chris Abrams, Anthony Sloan, our engineer, Errol Maitland, our technical director. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!